and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia,
this is WGTDHD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Guida Brown, former executive director of the Hope Council, Dr. Steve Brown, retired professor of educational leadership and school law, Dr. Karen Sconsert, chair of the education department and associate professor at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, Vice President for Community and Government Relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
Hello, I'm Karen Sconsert, and this is Education Matters. We'll be dissecting his book, The Fantasy Economy, Neoliberalism, Inequality, and the Education Reform Movement. Dr. Krauss earned his bachelor's degree from Le Moyne College in Syracuse, New York, and his master's degree and PhD from the State University of New York at Albany. Welcome, Neil.
Thanks very much for having me.
So the obvious place to start is the main title of your book. What do you mean by the fantasy economy?
Thank you. Well, the fantasy economy, what I mean by the concept is it's a misleading account of the economy and the education system that's in the interests of corporations and the wealthy. And I trace it primarily to the 1980 market would be, and about the education system and the relationship between education and the economy and the labor market. And there's sort of two main tenets in what I call the fantasy economy. They're very straightforward. One is that the education system is always inadequate. The K-12 education system, and more recently, second main tenet, and that is that the workforce is always inadequate as well. The skills of the workforce are never enough. And these two terms are repeated, these two concepts, I should say, are repeated these assumptions sort of endlessly. A lot of times they're not even repeated, they're just assumed. And they have really laid the groundwork for but yeah, at its core, it's really a misleading account of the nature of the labor market and also of the education system.
So let's get into the weeds of the education part. Since this is a program called Education Matters, what specifically does this have to do with K through 12 or college education? Like why are they supposedly inadequate?
Another emphasis is just increasing college attendance and college graduation rates, in general. And within those two sort of larger prescriptions, we have the whole list of reforms for the last. Online education has become kind of a huge emphasis of corporate education reformers as well, because the assumption is, of course, that the education system is just permanently broken. And therefore, we have to have charter schools, we have to have vouchers, we have to have test-based accountability, we have to adopt more, STEM programs and technical programs. And there's, these are just some of the major reforms. There's lots of others. So what the fantasy economy does is it places all emphasis on the education system in the whole discussion about economic opportunity and alleviating poverty and all those kinds of things. And because because inequality is widening, because wages remain stagnant for most people, the corporate leaders and foundation heads and education reformers will always turn the discussion back to education and say, well, what is K-12 and higher ed doing wrong here? What are they not doing right? Because after all, we still have education.
So I think one of the ways this resonates with me, because I prepare teachers, is that there is a supposed teacher shortage, K through 12 teacher shortage, both in Wisconsin and NAEP teaching. I think you find the same with nurses and lots of other areas where we claim that there's a shortage.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I've known a number of individuals myself personally who have teaching licenses, may have taught. I talk about in the book, there's really almost no shortages of any kind of skilled worker in the United States in the last several decades. There are very few actual shortages. In other words, as you accurately describe, you have to count the number of people with the right that are in the economy, because lots of those people are choosing to not you know, enter the profession, or perhaps they have left the profession. So it's not that we have a shortage of credentialed teachers, or, you know, there's, because wages went way up.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot more people went into the profession, and then, you know, labor markets actually kind of work, it turns out. And so then wages came down considerably.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's, you know, that's one of the themes of the book, that business is always going to say, there's a shortage of skilled workers, unskilled workers, this kind of worker, that kind of worker, because business is self-interested, and it's in their interest to say that. And, you know, I think only in education do we not understand that. Mm-hmm. The outside world gets that quite well. Organizations, and in order to do that, you talk constantly about shortages of all kinds of workers. Just can't find enough workers, you know, and the reality is quite different. There's plenty of workers at all skills.
Has a whole manufacturing program.
Mm-hmm.
School system in the case of the dual enrollment things. And then at the same time, and those wages for the people who go into those jobs are also stagnant. So here we're all getting involved trying to help, you know, make sure that manufacturing is well equipped, and manufacturing plants and the wages they pay or don't pay. And so I
to do a lot more than they do now, in the late 70s and 1980s. And the version of capitalism that we have ever since, which, you know, could call it neoliberalism, just this sort of belief in free markets, government, as needs of employees were important, and they were balanced with the needs of owners. And, you know, we had a largely, you know, a lot of people in labor unions up until the 50s. And also, I think we just have to change, you know, norms and expectations. That the minimum wage in Washington hasn't been raised in several decades. I mean, it's a travesty that's happened. And so we have this patchwork of minimum wage laws around the country. Business has to, you know, really run differently. And it's not going to do that voluntarily. So unions are a big part of it, and regulation and policy should be a big part of it too.
ITD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So I'm sorry to be jumping around like this. I do think what you said about things that used to be meant into Green Bay, which is where I grew up, and I went to a Walmart for the first time when I was visiting my family from where I was living in Indiana, and I was struck by all the Made in the USA signs on all of the stuff in that store. It was still a big box store, but it was really proud of the fact that everything was made in the USA. You'd be really hard pressed to find things that are made in the USA other than maybe food products in a Walmart today. And I think that's a really interesting kind of
overseas. You know, it was all sort of thought to be inevitable. It's just how progress, goes, basically, but money. In countries that have almost no regulations of anything. And yet, you know, you pay $45 for that shirt that costs, I don't know how much to make and ship over here. And the person selling it is making minimum wage. So, I mean, somebody's making a lot of money. Because that's really what I, you know, what how I frame the development of what I call the fantasy economy, that that, you know, really in the 1980s, 70s and 80s, when all, you know, plants kept closing and capitalism changed. And so, you know, owners really were salivating at the prospect of moving facilities. Corporation was really championing this whole way of doing things in a big way, because it was sort of, you know, marching lockstep with business and advocating for business at the expense of workers. And that's when we started to hear these claims about, you know, oh, the economy is going to be full of all these high education, high skilled jobs. And it's always right around the corner. So in the 1980s, it was by the year 2000, right?
Yep.
And then in the 90s, it's, I don't know, 2000 or 1985 or seven, that, you know, before long, you're going to need a graduate degree just to do anything. And that has that just hasn't happened. Right. And I would argue it can't happen given the nature of our economy, given the nature of, our economy is basically made up of, mostly of stuff, not of services, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mostly of things that we buy, objects that we buy, possessions, and then we replace and we buy more and we buy more and we use up resources. And, you know, it's not an information economy. It's not a data economy. It's nothing of the sort. I mean, it's an economy made up of stuff and consumption, personal consumption. So once we, you know, shifted away from manufacturing a lot of that stuff in this country, then we'd non-unionize. There's nothing inherently non-unionized about the retail sector or about the warehouse sector. It's just that corporations are fighting unions tooth and nail. It's stunning to me the extent to which retail and food services and a fairly small number of, you know, professional jobs and good paying business jobs and all the rest. So in the '80s, it was Walmarts that were being built all over and Home Depots, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that as well in New York State, that was going to go away if we give everybody a bachelor's degree in the region, mm-hmm. It just have people with bachelors working at them, you know?
So what you have a really great, what if thing in your introductory chapter, what if 15% more of the workforce suddenly had supposedly needed training in STEM jobs? What if we put out, you know, 15% more of the workforce, suddenly we, you know, snapped our fingers and they all had degrees in engineering.
Yeah.
Would happen to those workers?
Yeah. I mean, well, it's not going to change the number by giving more degrees along those lines to people. In the same way, we should, of course, give every student, and there's not going to be fewer Walgreens being built like on every fourth corner, standing high school education. That's impossible, right? And yet, if, you know, education is sort of permanently held responsible for all these labor market outcomes that we just cannot control. We cannot control. And that, by the way, I would argue, and I do argue in the book, that is really the overarching purpose of, you know, why what I call the fantasy economy was created, was to really make the entire discussion about economic opportunity in the United States a discussion solely about education.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a recent thing. That's a 1980s and 1990s development, you know, since that time. It's all we've heard for several decades. So we tend to think, well, hasn't it always been that way? No, it hasn't. It hasn't always been that way. As recently as the 50s and 60s and even into the 70s, you know, you could get a high school degree and you could go work in many parts of the country and live a fairly middle-class life within not too many years.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes be in a union and retire at age, you know, reasonable age and save and all the rest of it. Those
which would prepare you with, you know, sort of being, and I know I didn't put this specifically, reform of the last couple of decades was No Child Left
was sort of added on there. And now there's a recent push, and I'm sure you've seen it too. You know, the Gates Foundation and others are pushing, you know, it's all about math education. It's like the 1980s all over again,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, there's a great book by jobs that require advanced math, including jobs in STEM, because that's never been the case, really. And and yet, I mean, I'm all for math education, right? But let's stop talking about it in terms of you're going to need all this advanced math to do all these jobs, because that's not the case. That's not the case. Let's talk about it in terms of being an educated citizen and knowing math is important for just to be an educated person and to be fully human and to know science and history and literature and everything.
And to not be fooled by pie charts in the newspaper.
Yeah, understand what exactly.
Yeah. So listeners, I interviewed Andrew Hacker about 5 years ago. I will try to put that into the Facebook page post about this program so that you can listen to both of them.
Oh, great.
So that is a really interesting thing. And that is part of his argument also is about that you do need math and especially statistics to understand to be a good citizen. So
because, I mean, basic critical thinking when it comes to numbers, you know, there's a great book written, I think originally in the 1950s, called How to Lie with Statistics. And then it was republished, I think, in the 90s, I want to say. Because, I mean, statistics are continually misused, you know, the rate of increase of different things, which, depending on what you're talking about, can be almost meaningless. But, you know, if you put a number in the article or if you put a few numbers in this sentence, then a lot of people, including a lot of people with PhDs, are really in awe at that point. And it must be true and it must mean exactly what the person said it means because it's a number. But so, yeah, absolutely. There's all kinds of critical thinking that goes into evaluating statistics, not just statistics, but all kinds of numbers. And that's important for all citizens, really.
Right. So you've gone into a little bit about, you know, why that we have this fantasy economy, which assumes that more training will lead to higher wages and that everyone should be competing for this more training and it should be technical training, but it's really not true is your argument. So why do you think this fantasy economy was created? If we don't actually need as many people with specialized education for the economy, particularly in technical fields, who does it benefit to perpetuate this fantasy and who does it harm?
No, that's a great question. It benefits a number, you know, of interests here. Employers certainly benefit from an oversupply of STEM workers, of technical workers. I mean, there's a significant there has been for decades, and I talk about this in considerable detail in the book, including the federal government's withholding of a federal report, the Sandia report, which was commissioned by the Department of Energy under the George H.W. Bush administration, which really kind of laid out that, no, we have actually more than enough STEM workers as far as the eye can see. That report, it was so controversial that it was withheld. So that's still the case decades on, that there's more than enough people with those credentials. So it certainly benefits employers. Today, we see an awful lot of benefit among educational consultants, because the model is that the education system, the K-12 system and higher ed are permanently broken and they need fixing. And I mean, as you know, consultants are always there to fix everything in higher ed. And it's interesting because there's all this debate nationwide, including in Wisconsin, of course, about our budgets. And yet what's never talked about, talked about very infrequently among our leaders, is how much we're spending on consultants and new technology that really doesn't do anything for students. But yet we must buy it, right? We must buy everything that's presented to us. So there's so many interests that benefit from this emphasis on education. But I think that the overarching beneficiaries, and this is really what I argue in the book, is, you know, corporations and the wealthy, they benefit every single day because the whole discussion is about us. The whole discussion is about education and fixing inequality and fixing policy. And yet we can't, you know, raise people's wages. We can't create jobs. We can't give people less student loan debt. Education can't do any of those things. So it really was this, you know, what I argue in the book, it was this sort of massive deflection, because what neoliberalism was, the promise of neoliberalism was not a popular thing. I mean, you couldn't, you know, go to, you know, Green Bay or upstate New York or any place in Michigan or Pennsylvania. We're going to outsource your jobs. We're going to basically create an economy that's solely for owners and shareholders. Please vote for us. Thank you. That's not going to work. That's never going to work, right? So the whole discussion was shifted to, well, it's all about education, because after all, there are all these high-skill, high-education jobs that are right around the corner, because we're in a knowledge economy. And so it's up to the schools to give students knowledge so they can be participants and benefit from this knowledge economy. And we're not going to mention all the other stuff. We're not going to mention destroying unions and fighting minimum wage increases. We're not going to say those things out loud. We're not going to talk about them at all. We're going to change the discussion, make it all about education, and then move on. And that's really what has been, that's how it's been ever since. Mm-hmm. So as long as the discussion is solely about education, education is losing. And the people that make decisions, I want to, you know, make clear, I think a lot of people, I know a lot of people sincerely believe all this stuff. They sincerely believe it, and I understand why they sincerely believe it. Saying all these people are, you know, misleading intentionally, or I have no idea. I do know that, I mean, a lot of folks really seem to believe all this stuff, and I know why, because it's everywhere. It's in the air we breathe. It's in all press coverage. It's in, you know, it's hard to get through in education itself, I find, in higher education. Because I think we hear this stuff more than anybody else, because we're the target audience for it. But I think it's easy to people outside of education. They live in the real economy, so that they know, you know, yeah, I got a degree, I had a good job, and then my firm was bought by another firm, and I got laid off. I mean, they understand how things work. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think there are a lot of beneficiaries, but it's really, the clear loser is the education system, because it's on the receiving end of all this blame for things that it can't control.
Right.
Yeah.
A quick reintroduction. You're listening to WGTDHDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of the book, The Fantasy Economy, with political scientist Neil Krause, is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So we have about 6 minutes left. I want to ask you whether you think any of this neoliberalism has to do with the increase in educational opportunities for women and marginalized groups that happened in the 60s and 70s.
I think that, I think a lot of the sort of movement towards defunding public higher education is related to the increasing racial and gender diversity of higher education. In other words, higher education, and this is something that I don't think enough people fully grasp, that, you know, it wasn't just a few decades ago, very few people went to college. And it tended to be, middle, upper middle class, wealthy, overwhelmingly white, and largely male. And college attainment rates were very small. And then as college became more diversified, as you point out, in the 60s and 70s, there are different constituencies in higher education. And also, as K-12 became, as graduation rates increased, that's another thing that people, I think, tend to forget, that 40, 50 years ago, an awful lot of people dropped out of high school. Mm-hmm. And today the number is very small. So I think that when, both K-12 and then higher ed especially became more diverse, I think that those were key facts in changing the politics of higher education and changing, making it, easier, quite honestly, to defund it. Because there are different constituencies pursuing higher education. I think that's certainly a factor.
So how do you think we should reshape both K-12 and higher education based on this theory? What should education be for in the United States, if not for workforce readiness?
Well, I mean, I think that, I don't dispute that education is going to play some role in employment. I wouldn't go that far, but, I think that the model of education being for, citizens in a democracy and it is, and we should take very seriously. And that, education should be about, teaching students at all ages about all kinds of things that, science and math and literature and history and everything, to really help us all become fully human and grow as people and not just become, engaged citizens in a democracy, but also people who are well-versed in a variety of things and really can enjoy life that much more. Skills and knowledge and a whole variety of things, a film they saw in a class, a paper that they wrote, that they still think about this to this day, 30, 40, 50 years later, That stuff's crucial. That stuff's crucial. And that's what we're doing. And I think that those kinds of things are what education should be doing.
So our listeners
aren't a ton of STEM and technical jobs. There are plenty of jobs for students that major in all kinds of different things. And why are we getting rid of these kinds of liberal arts majors when they're important, for our students to learn? And they're also, things that can provide our students with jobs in the future. That's, I think, a concrete thing that people can do. Because it's not top secret, the number of engineering jobs or anything. This is all federal data that's easily accessible. The narrowing of the curriculum is something that really isn't popular with anybody except for the vested interests that benefit from that. So I think that's a very practical thing, because it's happening at everywhere. It's happening in kindergarten, first grade, all the way up to higher ed. The curriculum is always being narrowed based on myths about the labor market.
Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at WGTD.org.
I'm Gregory Berg, and I hope that you can join me for Monday's morning show here on WGTD. I'm going to be sharing the interview I recorded with best-selling author Greg Iles, talking about his latest novel called